Hey, Keith, this is Mike Murphy at KKFI in Kansas City.
Oh, hi, Mike. Okay, I've been standing by. You know, thank you for showing the interest.
Oh, I'm extremely interested. I've been a big fan of ELP. I remember seeing you on TV at, was it the US Festival or one of those things out in California, or the California Jam, maybe it was. And then I got to see...
Okay, you're showing your age.
I am. But then I got to see you in person at Madison Square Garden on 7/7/77. And you had the 60-piece orchestra with you. It was the Works Tour.
That one, yeah.
Yeah, that was amazing. And I've never been the same since.
Right, actually, so thanks both of us.
So I'm delighted to talk to you today. You've got a new album out with Greg Lake, live at Manticore Hall.
Yes. Well, it took a while for it to be released in the format that it is released in, but that's nothing unusual. In 2010, one of my associates that deals with the ELP's comings and goings, a guy called Martin Darville, and he was in California and suggested a meeting with an agent by the name of Jim Lenz. Their idea was for Greg and I to do a duo tour, which would warm Greg up and to a degree warm myself up in readiness for a high voltage festival to happen in London, England later on in the year. So I'd already had experience of playing with Californian musicians such as Mark Benier and Travis Davis on Mark Benier vocals and guitar, Travis Davis on bass, and Joe Travis, and a lot of brilliant, wonderful musicians in California. And sometimes Mark Benier, guitar vocals, and I had done duo gigs, so to speak. And I realized that the possibility of doing it with Greg Lake would work also. So that was it. You know, we set about rehearsing together. We rehearsed in Santa Monica. And then we got on. I think our first gig was in Cleveland. And that got off to a kind of a dodgy start because Greg had some problems with his rig. And I didn't have a sound check. And so if the concert had gone ahead, it would have been a complete nightmare. Although I could have made a kind of a joke out of it. I don't know, some unnecessary things. So it didn't, unnecessary things came out on Greg's website or whatever, but I had stage fright, which is complete nonsense. But, you know, I suggest, okay, you know, we needed a little bit more rehearsal, and which we did. And slowly the duo tour took off to... It was great fun, actually, and I think we were both disappointed when it came to an end. We had some wonderful exchanges with the orchestra, with the audience, like with the Q&A session. It was really, really, it was really fun, and I was very upset when the whole thing came to an end. There was one incident, I think, when this lady in the audience said what she'd always wanted to do was to come up. Was to lie under the piano while I played the piano for her.
Wow.
So she came up and she laid under the piano and I played and it made her day. So it was all full of it was very improvisational. So anyway, to carry on, it was wonderful, and it was a great chance for me to experiment with ELP classics, like From the Beginning and Lucky Man. I think when I actually presented Greg with a new arrangement of Lucky Man, he said, "Who wrote that?" And I said, "Well, you did." I mean, I didn't think it was that far removed from the original Lucky Man. We had some fun, and it all culminated with the High Voltage Festival in London, England, you know, with Carl on drums.
I imagine must have allowed you for different arrangements, you know, without the drummer, without Carl there. Other things may have been heightened.
Because the great thing about it was, of course, that the way that we had the stage set up was as if the audience were actually viewing something which is just going on. You know, they could see the engineer through the archway, and he was supplying some rhythmic orientations and whatever. So it was almost like the audience were like invited in into this very intimate studio recording. And of course what they heard was not exactly like the original DLP releases that Atlantic Records put out. It was, you know, we changed it a little bit. I changed Lucky Man to be a bit more in the period of 1970 or 71, whenever it was released in America. I know Greg apparently says that he wrote that when he was about 11. But when it was released, that was the time of the Vietnam War. So with the Moog synthesizer on the stage, I was able to reconstruct sort of like aerial bombardments and everything else. It was, you know, just to get the irony of Greg's lyrics, so to speak. So, you know, we made full use of what we could do, and, you know, I made full use of certain improvisations.
So you had the Moog with you?
Yes.
That's interesting. All these years later, you haven't found technology that could surpass that, or what is it that makes you go back to that sound?
Well, I think really any audience of mine would be disappointed to not see that wonderful piece of equipment that Dr. Robert Moog invented. And it certainly is very inspirational. I think really the Moog synthesizer fully defines what we've become to know as progressive rock music.
Well, a lot like the Beatles used the Moog and others used the Moog, but as far as I know, you were the first one to actually take it out of the studio and on the road. Is that?
Well, yes, and I don't think you'd find the Moog company disagreeing with that aspect. You know, there were other electronic instruments around at that time, way before Dr. Robert Moog began experimenting on oscillators and envelope generators and you name it, sequencers. There was things like the theremin, which had an aerial and you could make warbly sounds out of it, which I think the Beach Boys used in Good Vibrations.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the rough idea. But, you know, I think EMS, there were a few English companies which were copying it, and also in Japan, the Korg company were coming up with their own ideas too, based upon the same thing. From my aspect of it, as a keyboard player, it really opened up a lot of opportunities to play not only the Hammond C3, but to play the Steinway grand piano. It was incredible, actually. It was completely, I think it defined, as I've said already, the sound of what progressive rock is all about. But I'm really quite pleased that now in this year of 2014 that a lot of those pieces are now being accepted by orchestras like the Tokyo Philharmonic. Well, you name it. I'm going to be doing a concert very soon in the east part of New York, Long Island, and with an orchestra, and I don't think I'll be bringing the Moog synthesizer with me, but thing is that orchestras these days, and there is such a lot of talent with orchestras direct out of prolific companies like Juilliard, Berkeley, and a lot of what I've written for ELP is now almost becoming into the set list of orchestras.
I read recently, you mentioned, I don't know if it was the Tokyo Philharmonic or some other Japanese orchestra doing a performance of Tarkus.
Oh, yeah. Yep, that's right. I think you can find that actually on YouTube. You can find them playing it It blew me away, to be quite honest, you know.
Wow.
And a lot of what I've, what I did with ELP, I've turned it into more. I'm really, at the moment, in the process of adapting a lot of my music for the classical orchestra. You know, it's quite honestly, it is a challenge, but it's quite wonderful, because when I first started out playing with orchestras in the late 60s and then into the 70s, the orchestras were pretty much hostile towards rock musicians that thought they were playing classical music. But I'm very pleased to say that the whole scenario, the whole thing about classical music and classical musicians, and I say that in parentheses, they've got a great understanding of jazz, they've got a great understanding of all sorts of music, and if one was to say to a violinist in the orchestra, can you play that in a kind of a Irish fiddle sort of way, they could do it. You know, it's, you could never have done that in the early 70s. They'd have thought you were mad, you know. So it's just, I'm so pleased that the wheel is going round full circle. And I mean, there is nothing, as Rick Wakeman has said to me, he said, there's nothing like hearing your music played by a 70-piece symphony orchestra. You know, we both experienced it as the late John Lord did, of Deep Purple. Thankfully, we both experienced all of that. And I think that's the direction that music is going to go in.
You think so?
Of course, first of all, you have to break it down into what it's all about. With Emerson, Lake and Palmer, with the music I wrote, it all started off with playing on the piano and graduated from there. But I never actually thought that we'd go any further.
Hmm.
I had a lot of encouragement from great guys like Frank Zappa, who I knew very well. And, it was a struggle for Frank Zappa in the 60s, but we worked at it, and I'm really pleased that... I think the symphony orchestra is really going to take off in the future.
You mentioned having known Frank Zappa well. You've never worked with him musically, did you?
Not musically, no, but we discussed a lot of possibilities with group and orchestra and how to combine group and orchestras together. I think America was a little bit more receptive towards that idea than what England was. But I'm pleased to say that in my experience, and having recorded in Norway with the Munich Symphony Orchestra and into Tokyo, I'm pleased to say that I think this is pretty much where, orchestras want to go. They are starved of new material, number one,
Yeah.
Quite honestly, they know Beethoven's Fifth Symphony without a conductor,
right.
And that's what it's like. But they want to be tested, they want challenges, and you've got to remember that, kids coming out of Juilliard and Berklee and all these great music schools, their fathers have listened to progressive rock music.
Yeah, that's right.
And they are inspired by it. They know Beethoven, they know Mozart, they know... to a degree, Shostakovich, then Wagner. It's all part of their standard repertoire that they learn at music school. I never went to music school, but I do know quite a lot about it. Of course I do.
Yeah, I'd say so. I didn't realize you never went to music school. I just always assumed that.
No, I regard myself as self-taught.
Oh, wow, that makes things even more amazing. Wow, I had no idea. So,
I never went to the London School of Music or whatever. Rick Wakeman did.
Yeah.
Jordan Rudess went to Juilliard. Yeah, I mean, that's great. But I think there's something for... being self-taught, which I regard myself as.
Yeah, and on one hand, there's no preconceived notions, right?
Like it's what?
There are no preconceived notions with your approach to music. You know, if you're discovering things on your...
Preconceived notions. Well, I know what to write. I know how to write it down on a manuscript. And I know how to orchestrate. And I know how to deliver it to other musicians. So I think that's all you basically need.
Yeah, I'd say so. I'd say you're doing all right. I'm curious about what kind of music you listen to. So maybe you could tell us maybe the last recorded music you listened to and also the last live music you've experienced.
Last recorded music? Well, you know, my choices are very varied. Probably, let's see. Maybe Shostakovich's second piano concerto, Bitches Brew by Miles Davis, and then some other crazy stuff which I listen to with my grandchildren.
What do your grandchildren listen to?
Well, actually, I've just given my grandson an hour's piano lesson, and he's doing the usual Beethoven, you know, Thurlis, and I'm trying to interest him in merging it with things like Greensleeves, but developing it and kind of making it his own. He's pretty bright. He's only about 7 years old. But I think the main important thing about teaching children is to make it fun. Like, you know, if he's playing Greensleeves, I've got a printout of Robin Hood, which is about period about when Greensleeves came out, you know?
Right.
Cartoon version of Beethoven. So, you know, you keep the interest going, you know. It's not like when I was learning the piano and I got this very sort of bitter piano teacher standing over me and going, no, it's wrong. You know, and basically screaming at me, you know. So that put me off of any lessons, really. That's why I went and decided, I'll teach myself, which I did.
Wow. So what about the last live music you experienced?
Last live concert? Crikey. I don't really go to many live shows. My girlfriend does. She just went and saw Toto at the Greek Theatre.
Wow. But it's been a while for you. Is it hard for you to, like, sit in an audience and not want to get up on stage and show them how it's done?
No, I'm okay. I've been to so many things. It's a bit of like, as they say in England, it's been like a busman's holiday, you know. Yeah, I'm okay. But, you know, she likes going to these things, and I know most of the guys in Toto, so I give them a call, and, you know, usually she's okay. She gets a ticket, and she's well looked after, you know.
Oh, that's great. So, a couple other things.
No, for me, I'm not really that interested. If there was something unusual going on here in Sussex, like a bagpipe band playing with a rock ensemble, I would definitely check that out.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's completely different.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, I like unusual stuff and unusual combinations. You know, the thing is about, you know, with modern bands like Foreigner, which are great bands, the thing is that they don't vary it. You know, it's basically that they're playing exactly the same thing that they played on the record. And if they deviate from that, then I think backstage arguments pursue. You know, it's like, what did you do there? You know, that wasn't on, you know. No, I can't stand that. I think if you're going to go out to a gig, you've got to take the time and the effort to drive, find a parking space, and go. If you're not going to hear anything different at all, you might just as well stay at home.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is that, and I know this as a fact, the last concert I did was for the Moog Festival in North Carolina, and before I started, I said, don't expect to hear it exactly like the record. We're going to branch out a little bit. And the applause was great.
Oh, good.
You know, it's all well and good. Okay, so Greg and I possibly get out on the stage and we do Lucky Man, everybody wants to hear Lucky Man. That's fine. I've got no objection to that. And of course, yes, I'll play the Moog solo, which I played on the original. But then I'll branch out a bit. At least they've got a statement of what they heard at home. But it's going to go on a bit longer. And, you know, the same thing with classics like Booker T and the MGs, Green Onions. Well, we all know how that goes. And we know how the start of his organ solo goes. But okay, fine. But then branch out from there, you know. That's the whole point of live performances live.
I don't disagree with you. So in addition to the Moog Fest that you went to this year and headlined that, you also were, I understand, inducted into the Hammond Hall of Fame.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that was, there's some great players there. I mean, there was no rehearsal, but, jammed along. I mean, the Hammond organ actually aimed to excel a lot in jazz music, you know. Although it did make a lot of great appearances in what we now know as progressive rock music, it has a place there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, there we are. I just did a radio show in London where I really had to search through a lot of progressive rock things. I came across Fox Beard, I came across I thought I had the list in front of me, but I don't. You know, I think progressive rock music has situated itself firmly in Scandinavian countries.
Isn't that interesting?
I'm not sure how big it is in Kansas, where you are, but I know that Boston was pretty big on progressive rock.
Yeah, well, you know, the band Kansas is from Kansas. Also, on an appreciation level, we have a guy here in town who's actually celebrating his 40th anniversary as being a progressive rock DJ, and it's called Majesty's Voice, and he's also worked with a lot of making sure that progressive acts get to this part of the country.
Boy, yes. I mean, Kansas is an incredible band. You know, I really admire them. You know, there are other bands. I think I may have mentioned Jordan Rudess with Dream Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Although they seem to, as I've told Jordan about this, I think that Dream Theater bonds slightly heavy metal. It's quite, I think it's quite humorous about how people define all this music. You know, when ELP started in 1970, nobody knew what to call ELP's music. They said, well, what do you call yourself? So we drew a blank on that one. We basically said, well, I think it's, I'd say it's contemporary. Contemporary rock. Oh, okay. Going way back into the 60s when I had a band called The Nice, the same question was asked. Again, I kind of drew a blank on that and settled upon, well, it's underground. It's underground music. It's psychedelic. You know, in the 60s, it was all flower power and caftans and flowers in the hair. Psychedelic, underground. So we settled on that. It wasn't until ELP disbanded that suddenly we heard the name progressive rock being associated with what we did. We've had, you know, Emerson, Lake and Palmer were, the reason for the name was the fact that I always knew that eventually we'd always go our own separate ways, which is what has happened. When the time comes, we do get back together again. Can't really extend it any further than that.
You guys have done some amazing music collectively and separately over the years, and have quite a body of work.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. Well,
which was the first gig you saw me at?
It was at Madison Square Garden, July 7th, 1977. 7-7-77. And it was the Works Tour, and it was with the 60-piece orchestra.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing. The other
did I spin round on the piano?
You did spin round on the piano, yeah.
Oh, bloody hell. Okay.
Yeah, it was the full ELP menu, plus more, because now with this orchestra, I mean, you know, and Works was brand new, and it was amazing.
Well, that's brilliant.
Pirates is still imprinted in my brain. Whenever I hear, you know, that Pink Floyd song that says, a warm thrill of confusion, that Space Cadet glow. I always associate that with me being at that Madison Square Garden ELP show.
And how old were you?
I was just graduated high school, so I was just about to turn 18.
What would that be? What age would that be?
Well, I'm 54 now. I'll be turning 55 later this year.
If
all goes according to plan.
Well, I'm turning 70 in a couple of months' time, so there we are.
Oh, that's incredible. And did you think when you were starting out with the NICE that you'd be still going at 70?
No. Well, actually, I don't know, the music always went before me. I thought, well, I know this is going to work in the future, even if nobody understands what the hell I'm doing at the moment. I always remember my father saying to me that he said, well, if you're going to go into playing music to audiences, he said, you'll never make any money playing stuff like that. And you know what? He's bloody right. I'm not very rich playing what I do, but that... I couldn't give a shit, you know?
Yeah.
The greatest moment for me was flying to Tokyo and hearing Tokyo Philharmonic 80-piece orchestra playing my compositions. I mean, I think, well, that's it. But even if I don't come up with another thing, that's good for me, you know? On that note, Mike?
Keith, thank you so much.
Okay, man.
All right. Take care now.
Okay, there's fucking dogs now, so I've got to go.
All right, take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.